Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey guy, how are you?
Yeah, well, I'm all right. I've been out and about in the old town in, I can't remember which Baltic state we're in today. We're in Latvia.
We're in Latvia.
Another Baltic state.
We're in Riga.
Oh, in yes, which is in Latvia.
Yeah, and I feel really bad about this because I don't know whether until I saw the tour schedule a few months ago that I even knew of Riga.
No, it's a very beautiful old town. I've already been out and about.
Yeah, and it's quite funky as well. There's a lot of really cool people around, you know. Do you know what's interesting now is, unlike touring in the old days, you can get an haute cortado anywhere.
You can, and you can get there by scooter.
And you can get there by scooter. But I'm really keen to talk to Brian Adams about life on the road, because he seems to spend half his life on the road.
I really want to talk about that, because I've just looked at it, because he really does do like 3 weeks off, 3 weeks on, a month on, a month off.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. And just the change that's gone on, because, you know, we're the same age. He's been doing it for roughly the same time. He's hugely successful. I mean, you know, he's sold about 100 million albums. He's had Oscar nominations and everything.
What's extraordinary is he's actually got a CV as a photographer, which any photographer would be happy to have. You know what I mean? It's like that would do just fine as a career.
He took a picture of the Queen.
He did. He's photographed everyone from Amy Winehouse to, and then his fantastic books on, like, you know, war veterans and also campaigning. And
he's an activist, right, as well.
He is very much,
you know, we need to get back to his roots. We need to find out about the real Brian Adams and what drives him.
Oh, you know, but I was going to say, because all the interviews that I've heard, you know, in our usual endless research, is does seem very skimmy. And I do think there's not a lot about the early days, which I do think we should delve into.
Well, let's unskim the Adams. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Good morning.
Yay!
Good morning.
Ryan. Hey, all right?
Yeah, how are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you fine.
Can we get your visuals?
Hang on, how do I do this? Start video. There you go.
Oh, wow, man. You're looking great.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Are you in Glasgow, Brian, or have you gone home for the night?
Yeah, I'm Glasgow.
Cool.
Well, you're obviously in the art on your walls is a lot better than the art here in Riga. We're on tour as well. We're in Latvia. We've got a little I've got a little photograph hanging here, and Guy's got nothing behind
him. This is pure Soviet era recreated hotel room.
Looks like a Squality Inn. Where are you?
No, we're in Riga, in Latvia.
Oh, you're both in Riga?
Yeah, we're on tour together.
We play with Nick Mason.
I knew that.
Nick Mason, and we're on a 9-week European tour. And actually, this is quite a good start, really. You know, you spend so much time on the road. I know how it feels for us. 9 weeks feels extremely daunting. And for, I think, if you've got kids especially, you know, that's because I love being on stage. But it's the being away from home that's the hardest part, I think.
It is tough. Also, it's nice to get away as well.
There is that. But because, Brian, you have this, you've often said you like to do this thing of being kind of a bit on the road, bit off, bit on the road, bit on the road. And we're looking at your dates, and you really are. You do like 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, and it's like that's forever, right? It seems.
Yeah. I 2 weeks on, like do two sets of weekends, and then go back home.
Does that mean you have like a crew permanently sort of fired up and ready to go?
Well, it means that I pay for a lot more airline flights. But it's, at the same time, I think I get a better quality of life because I'm not just out in the squalidy ends of the world all the time. And there's only so much beige that a man can handle.
So do the crew and the rest of your band, do they all go home or do they wait somewhere on the road for you?
Everyone goes home. And so everybody has a life.
But because I think it's the being on stage bit we love, isn't it? Do you have, though, over the years, have you developed a kind of world that keeps you sane? So are there sort of elements of things that you travel with or people that you travel with that make it seem more normal for you, more homely?
Yeah, hang on a sec. Someone's calling me here. Hello? The fire alarm's going off at 12:30. Okay, thanks very much.
Brilliant. Great. Well, we'll try to be done before the fire alarm goes off. That's usually is that your way of getting interviews ended? You have some call me and say the fire alarm is going to go off.
Exactly right, yeah.
But do you have a world that makes you feel happier? That you've built up?
I think I've got to say that because I've had the same team such a long time, that we all sort of prescribe to the same thing. You know, we all like to go home. And I remember when I first started doing it, or saying that I wanted to do it, my management was like, everyone's going to leave you. No one's going to stay on tour. You're just going to have a skeleton. You forget it. It's not going to work. One guy left. And that was 20. I mean, when did we start? I started doing this in 2000, so what are you, 22 years ago?
Yeah.
Guy, are you wearing your pajamas?
No, I'm not. I'm just wearing a nice Sunspell top.
We're 2 hours ahead of you, so I'm hoping he isn't.
I've been out and about. I've been to the cathedral. I've done all the old town. I've done everything this morning. I've been a good tourist.
In your pajamas.
In my pajamas, yes.
I mean, that's the thing, actually, that we've found ourselves doing, which we love, which is wherever we go, we try and find out about the city, the tourism. You know, we try and visit
wherever
local
you
places.
Go. You wear your pajamas. Wherever. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Should I take this off? Is it off putting? I mean, it's really not.
No, leave it on, mate. Leave it on. Please leave it on.
For those just listening, it's a pair of pajamas he's actually wearing. Listen, I'm trying to get to a point that I'm interested in, right?
God, what were you saying?
We obviously know, you know, you have vegetarian, there's a lot of activism in your life. Are there rules about what people are allowed to have backstage? You know, because the one thing that upsets me is the proliferation of plastic bottles that appear behind every single gig we ever do. Do you have rules in advance for what the crew can eat and what everyone can
drink
from?
I mean, my tour is pretty much plastic free. We a long time ago, we stopped that and we have filtered water everywhere. And the catering is all vegetarian. And so if everyone gets per diem anyway, so if they want to go get a burger, they can, you know. Those are the only two things that are sort of prescribed to the ethos that you were talking about. But there's no rules, really. It's just every man for himself. You know what it's like.
Yeah.
We're on the road.
Let's talk about a new album, Brian. Because
as he cackles.
We have to talk about the new album because how you wrote it is interesting. I actually ended up doing my only new solo album in lockdown, you know, because for me, lockdown became, you know, I had to find creativity in it. And I know that's how you approach this new one. Take us through that.
I honestly think I would have done it anyway. It's just that it was the perfect opportunity to just unravel everything that I had sort of stored up in the last year or two before that and empty all the pieces of paper out of my coat pockets that have scribbles on them and start making songs. And I put together a board and I started writing all the song titles that I had up on the board. And every day I would sit with my engineer Hayden, who's sitting here right here.
Oh, hi Hayden.
And we would work on songs like we're doing right now. So I everywhere I go, I have a studio set up and we just work on songs in the daytime.
But you were playing everything yourself, weren't you? And you're, do you like to work at the early stage? How soon do you like to take stuff to the band usually?
Well, I couldn't find a bass player, so, you know.
Yeah, and I was using your bass anyway. By the way, thanks for lending me your bass.
You bet. I've always sort of dabbled in doing bits and bobs of my own, you know, like doing all the tracks. But this time there was no way of getting the band in the room. So I just bought a drum kit started messing around. So we had this thing. So I would put down a track on the drums and then come back in. I look at Hayden over here and I'd say, would Bonham have done that? He'd go, no. That's it. All right. Go back in again. So the whole thing was like, would Bonham have done that? And that's how I try to get the drum tracks.
That's quite a bar to set yourself, though, isn't it?
Well, you know, if you're going to set
Jeff
a bar...
Would Jeff Beck have done that?
It's just to make it as powerful and as rocking as possible.
Yeah. Listen, Brian, I can't think of anyone in the world further from the personality of John Bonham than yourself.
It was just whether or not it was rocking enough.
And it's interesting because I think the drums on this album... They reminded me, the sound reminded me a lot of the early stuff from of Reckless and the sound on that.
Really? Oh, that's kind. Well, I mean, it was just all done in a bedroom.
Amazing.
There's a lot of nonsense talked about drum sounds and always has been, I reckon. It's that, you know, Bonham's most legendary drum sound was just in the hallway at Headley Grange. You know, it wasn't at Olympic.
That's right. It was the bottom of a staircase,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
You work a lot with other people. You co-write. I mean, I'm a solo songwriter. I find it more difficult to write with other people. And in the situation you were in, how did you find that same inspiration? There are two questions here. There's one about that with this album, but also about how you approach songwriting with other people generally.
Well, I kind of have friends that I... Like, for example, Jim Vance, who I work with my entire life. And so we finished doing Pretty Woman the Musical together. And there was a bunch of ideas left over from that that either got cut by the director or they weren't appropriate musically. So I thought, you know, never one to give up a good song. I just would rework them. And that was one aspect of it. And then there was working with Mutt Lang, who I love working with. We would just do that by email. I would send a chorus to him or something, an idea for a song, and then he'd send back what he thought would go with it. And in the past, I did the same thing with Ed Sheeran once for Shine a Light.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where I sent him a chorus for the song, and he sent me back a verse. And I was like, oh, that works. Great song. So I don't care where the idea comes from. It's the best idea wins.
Do you ever write on your own, Brian?
I do, but I find that I get a little bit bored with just doing it on my own, so I send it off to somebody. I've got a really good chorus right now for a song, and I'm trying to decide what to do with it. So do I finish it myself or nah, I'll give it someone else to mess around with, you know? Because one of the joys I had back in the 90s was working with Michael Kamen.
Oh.
And it was wonderful because he would come up with musical ideas that I would never have come up with, and vice versa. So I think that, you know, obviously, Guy, you know.
I knew.
Michael,
well,
right?
We both worked on a film together with him, the Don Juan DeMarco movie.
Oh, did you play bass on that?
I played guitar on that. But he wanted everyone he knew to that beautiful line, that da 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 da. He had this idea of having mass guitars doing it, mass Spanish guitars. And he kind of called up every guitarist he knew, and he thought that wasn't enough people. So then he started calling him, so that I ended up coming in. It was great. I remember you being in the studio at Whitfield Street a couple of times.
So, I mean, he was wonderful. And so pushing your boundaries is what it's about, mm-hmm. Gary. It's about not coming up with what you usually come up with. It's about coming up with something that you wouldn't ordinarily come up with. And that's what either pushes you or makes a song more interesting. If I could come up with it, great, but I usually don't. I usually come up with what I come up with, and then let's see what someone else comes up with.
Is part of it editorial, Brian? I mean, when I said just the thing of you're writing something on your own and it's just kind of, is this any good? And having someone else in the room to kind of confirm that what you're doing is working and is right. Is that in any way part of it, you think?
I wouldn't give somebody an idea of a song, but I didn't think it was any good.
No, true, you know, like
I would usually say, right, I think this is a good idea. And way back, just before I made the album Waking Up the Neighbors, I had written a whole album of songs, and I started working with Mutt, and I played Mutt the songs thinking that Mutt was going to produce them. And Mutt looked at me and said, well, you know, that's nice. I said, what do you mean? He goes, yeah, I think you could do better. I say, okay, what do you want to do? He goes, start again. So we scrapped an entire record.
Wow.
and took pieces of it and rewrote the songs and made it up Waking Up the Neighbors. So another point actually is being not precious about your songs, not precious about your ideas. And that's when I learned to actually not be precious about little things you come up with or the songs you come up with. That, you know what, it could be better. And so make it better.
I think that there's something else going on here as well, because for me as a songwriter, that's how I see myself. I see myself primarily as a songwriter, even if I'm doing a solo album. You are also a singer, a major singer. So it's all about what can be created for you to present yourself as vocally, and for you to enjoy that vocally.
You might be right, actually.
You know, you enjoy singing, and you it's an incredible tool. And if you were not a songwriter, it would still be something you could be very successful at. And so sometimes you might be interested, what are other people going to deliver to me to give me an opportunity to project myself?
I've never thought that, but you're right. There's something in it to that. Because
I mean, we'll get on a bit more maybe later about Michael Kamen. I worked with Michael, obviously. He did the theme music for the Craze movie. And,
cool.
And he also he produced the last sort of Spandau Ballet track back in 1990.
I'll tell you a funny story about Michael. And just for those people that don't know Michael, Michael was a film composer. I remember when we did Don Juan DeMarco, he called me up very late one night. It was about 11:30 something. And he said, did I wake you? I said, no. He said, I've got a problem. I said, well, what is it? He says, well, the director doesn't like what I've written for the film. And I just wondered if you would come over and have a listen to it. I said, sure, I'll come over tomorrow. He goes, no, could you come over now? So I said, sure, okay. So I got in my car and I drove over to Notting Hill. And he sat me down. By this time, it's midnight. And you know, have you ever been to Michael's place? Did you ever go to his little studio there?
Yeah. Many times. So
you know what it's like. And you can imagine the scene. And he's Michael. And he plays me this piece of music, which was ba-da-da-dum, 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 ba-da-da-dum. And after I listened to it, I went, Michael, I think that could be one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard. What else do you have? And then he played me the da 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 da. And I said, what if you put those two pieces of music together and make one piece of music? And he went, what a good idea. And so we did that, and then we wrote that song together.
Wow.
And then the director was happy, and everyone went home happy. But it was just one of those sort of things that a late night session at Michael's. He needed to hear the confidence that his music was good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, Michael, not only is this good, this is amazing. You know, you've done incredible writing. So I could never have written that, ever.
You know, I think it's foolish to go back and to try and do this chronologically. We're talking about Michael now. Let's be more organic. I think, you know, obviously your first connection with Michael is on Everything I Do.
Yes.
And which is obviously to this day still has the record for the longest amount of weeks at number one when singles meant something.
Yeah, it was 17 years it was at number one, I believe, wasn't it?
It's still number one.
it was a sort of slight personal thing for me as well, because I after that film, which I saw endlessly on the video of Robin Hood and Kevin Costner, I ended up working with Kevin after that on The Bodyguard, and he came to life before my eyes after seeing him endlessly on Top of the Pops. But the writing of that song I'm interested in, because obviously it came originally from Michael's orchestral ideas, right?
Yes. So what happened was I was sent a cassette tape, you remember them?
Oh, yeah.
Of 45 minutes of score. And we were in the process of finishing up Waking Up the Neighbors album. And there was a guy called David Kirschenbaum, who was a producer, and he'd obviously sent it out to a few people and sent it to me as well. And I sat down with Mutt and we listened to it. And there was one section in the score that went, and Mutt said, oh, that's nice. And I said, yeah. And then what we did, instead of, if you listen to the song, you'll notice that we don't get in the way of that melody. It's a da 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 down, look into my da da down, you will see. So it's a counterpoint. Mm-hmm. And that worked beautifully. And then we sat down and we wrote the rest of the song. But it was based around that theme. and the middle eight and all that happened. We were up in Wilston. We were in Battery Studios.
Batteries. Oh yeah, yeah. Wilston Lane. Yeah.
Yeah, Wilston Lane. Yeah, and we were up there in the back of the studio, and the song literally from the moment we started it to completing the whole arrangement was about 45 minutes. It just happened.
Because after that had been a hit for quite a while, because I remember I went to see the film in Australia and it had been out for a while then. And at key points in the film, the great romantic moments in the film, that theme happens. And it's so brilliant, such a brilliant bit of subliminal placing that you come out of that film. And if you're going to have to buy that record. You can't not.
Yeah, well, there is a little bit of a backstory to it, is that no one really liked the song at the film company at the time.
Wow.
And they tried to get me to change the song title to I'll Die For You. And I said, nah, I'm not changing anything. If you don't like it, too bad. If you go see the film, you'll notice that the song doesn't actually appear until after this gigantic, massive score happens. Yeah. And the Dolby sign starts to come up and it says the end. But then the song comes in. So like they weren't happy with it. They were very happy with what happened with it afterwards.
What do you think is the key to the magic of that song?
Mutt said to me when he listened to that little snippet, he said, that is a universal melody.
I
agree. I think Michael was very good at writing themes that were quite universal.
I think and this is slightly technical for some of our listeners maybe, but I think it's that pedaled bass note when it goes to the fourth chord or the fifth chord, when you go from C.
Yeah, that's technical for our listeners, F. All right.
And yeah, no, and the bass just stays.
When it pedals the bass, that's the one.
And it's just so beautifully romantic, and it doesn't feel conventional. I guess you know that's the skill of Mutt as well, because Mutt has that great musicality, doesn't he? That
he is very, very clever, and he did a very good job of producing that track. As he does many, many tracks. But I mean, he just understood everything about what was necessary to make that song what it is. And including the moments where I hit the high notes, you know, all the crescendo of music that happens, and, you know, it happens a couple of times.
Yeah.
So who knows what the secret is, but I mean, it's still number one.
It still is number one. It's now 47 years, I believe, it's been number one.
It's coming up. Yeah.
But Brian, Mutt is famous. I remember being, for how long he takes, I remember being down in Dublin when Def Leppard were making their album in the mid-80s with Mutt. And it had already been going for about 2 years.
I'm very protective about him because I don't believe that he's doing it because he wants to spend 2 years on a record. He did it because he wanted the best songs to be on the album, and he would have done it for me. He would have done it for anybody he'd worked with. It was never, ever a moment of like, that's all right, we'll just let that one slide. No way. Nothing slides. You get the best on every single song, and that's it. And you work and you work and you work until you get the best.
But to go back, I'm sorry, chronology is out the window here, because you're always used to that super high-end audio thing, because you started working with Bob Clearmountain very early in your career, didn't you?
It's true.
You know, Bob's as posh as it gets as well. He's...
Yeah, Bob's a bit of a punk rocker.
He is, but his records don't sound like that.
Well, I was attracted to Bob's sound from a record that he did with Jim Carroll back in the late 70s, early 80s, called The City Drops Into the Night. Do you know that song?
No. No,
it's really, really good, and the drum sound was like really good. I'm like, oh, and I called up Kirschenbaum, the guy actually who was the guy that introduced me to Michael, and I said, who made this record? And he said, oh, I know the guy that made this. His name is Bob Clearmountain. He's a young engineer out of New York, and Bob had just also remixed The Stones' "Miss You."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and so yeah, we met, and it was like, let's make a record. My early records were kind of punk influenced as well, in the sense that they were quite raucous, and but I would still do the odd ballad because I like a ballad.
Well, yes, and you're very good. That's actually something we wanted to get to, because when you appeared on the scene, you were very much, I certainly very much saw you as a sort of new wave act, in the way that it was just, you know, authentic, real rock and roll. In the same way as, I guess, I put in the same ballpark as like Tom Petty or someone like that.
Yeah, the Cars.
I loved the Pretenders, yeah. The Cars, all those bands back then. Those are the records I was listening to.
Yeah. Because you always trumpet sort of much more traditional rock and roll stuff as your grounding, though, don't you?
Almost rockabilly at times.
Almost rockabilly at times, yes. I mean, I love rockabilly music.
But that's what's so great about those early records of yours is that the fact... What's interesting is how people didn't really become aware of this sort of sonically until later on, but you were making just great classic-sounding rock and roll records, which means that they haven't dated. You know, they still sound great.
I think there are moments in some of the songs where you hear the DX7 come through and you think...
Well, that's what I would have thought. Into the Fire is kind of... That's the first time you're making something that sounds like his record.
That's right.
And I think that's where that fell down a bit for you.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
And it was... Jim had discovered this keyboard called the Emulator, and it was full of massive samples of things. So even if the song was crap, it sounded amazing because the drum sounds were so good. Mm-hmm. And so I think we got bewitched by the magic of synthesizers.
Yeah, no, you did. There's this big bass synth and that drum sound.
The real nucleus of good records is a good song, play with the band. Everyone looks at each other when you finish a song and you go,
yeah,
that felt great.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting, that in that sense, Into the Fire gave you a lesson in what should be your own philosophy for the rest of your career, really.
Yes and no. I went straight from Into the Fire into working with Mutt, which was very much about working on the Fairlight and samplers and all this stuff, which I'd never, ever used. It was just completely foreign to me. You know, I would write 10 songs, go in the studio with the band, spend 5 days cutting tracks, mix it. I mean, the first album was done in 2 weeks. I couldn't imagine spending 2 weeks on an album now. It's
2 weeks on a snare sound.
two weeks on a song. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Things have changed. I mean, mind you, I would have been much more prepared going into a studio then than I am now. Because now what I do is I sit in hotel rooms or wherever I am, and I continue to craft. And then it's not like making demos, because demos, there's no point making a demo anymore.
No,
you just make your master.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, because whatever you start with is what you can take with you. That's everything's changed so much.
Yes.
Yeah. So there isn't that excuse of, it's just not quite, I haven't got the thing the demo had.
It is a demo.
Yeah, exactly.
Brian, I want to talk about your relationship with Jim Vallance and how it began, really, because, I mean, obviously there's been moments when you and Jim have separated, and obviously when you began the Mutt Lange connection.
Jim and I continued to work together with Mutt. We used some songs that sort of taken out of my album that didn't come out, because those songs ended up being sort of regurgitated into different songs.
But how did you come into each other's lives, I think, is the question I'm asking.
Oh, great. We actually met in a music shop. I was just 18, and he was talking to this cellist who I thought was quite fanciable. And he was talking to her, and I went up and I knew her. And I said, "Hi, Allie, how you doing?" She goes, "Oh, this is Jim Vallance." And I was like, "Oh, Jim." And in the conversation, he just said, "Well, look, do you want to get together and have a cup of tea sometime?" And I was like, "Yeah, that'd be great." And I walked out of that shop and went, great. I knew something was going to happen. I already liked what Jim had been doing. When we were on the studio scene, there was a keyboard player called Robbie King, who was an amazing organist and used to hire me for sessions. And I was sort of beginning to enter into the world of being a background vocalist, because I didn't have anything else going on.
You're incredibly young, though, aren't you?
Yeah, I started doing studio work when I was about 15 or 16.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but I just put myself forward all the time. Got a funny story, but I remember one of the first sessions I ever did, the pianist handed me a chart with four singers, and he went, "Okay, two, three, and in with the song, and it goes like this." And it finished, and I said, he said, "Look at me," and he said, do you know the melody?" I said, "I do now." And then he said, "Do you want the third or the fifth?" Do the third. Right. So then I would learn from hearing what he'd done, because I can't read music.
Yeah, join the club.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Would you say your relationship with him is sort of similar to Elton and Bernie?
Well, not really, because we both write lyrics write music.
But that thing of just being you'll go off somewhere else, but it's sort of always there.
I love Jim. Mm. He's my brother, you know. I mean, I can count on Jim, you know. It's like, I know that if I said to him today, "I got a song, you know, it's got to be about the rock and tours, tomorrow morning we'd have a song about it.
Can't wait to hear it.
But as it developed, and obviously, you know, you went through those first couple of albums, what was it that changed, that helped you to create, you know, Reckless as such a key part of your career? I mean, you know, I still would say that, you know, Run to You, I remember when it came out in the 80s and I was recording with Spandau Ballet down in Germany, and we all heard it and we went, my God, this is the template for the future of rock music. It sounded,
well, that's so very kind. I think what I figured out was that you can't sit in the studio all the time. You've got to go play live. Mm-hmm. And so I used to take after my first album, which did nothing, I just went out and took my songs and played them in clubs and figured out tempo, what was working, breakdowns, you know, what lyrics were working, and just when it came into working with Clear Mountain, I'd had a very concise idea already of how I wanted to sound. It was just about getting the sound.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We wanted to pick up where we left off, really, with the Reckless album. I wondered about Heaven, because Heaven nearly never made Reckless, did it? And it, I think it was your first song for a movie.
The story was, it was written for a film that was about a male stripper. And I never really wanted to... Once I saw the film, I was like, oh, what? And so I just didn't really want to publicize it. But they put out a soundtrack album for it and everything. And even though I wouldn't let them release it as a single from the soundtrack, the song just kept getting picked up and people started playing it everywhere. So when it came time for Reckless, I thought, I'll save it for the album, because putting it on the album made more sense than advertising a dodgy soundtrack. So that's the story.
But it was interesting that the movie inspired you in a way, because, or was it the other way around? Did you have that song and then you thought you'd deliver?
It was written for the film.
And yet it was a massive change in your career.
Yeah, so because Reckless is where everything went kind of properly global, isn't it? What do you say? Or...
It went to England. because we'd had a...
That's what I meant. Properly global. England.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Heaven wasn't a hit in the UK. It was only a hit really in America and Canada at the time. And it still has never been really a chart hit anywhere other than that.
But that's quite extraordinary, because we look at those songs as being complete smash hit classics, and yet they're sort of ones that people have gone back and discovered after maybe, you know, waking up the neighbors.
Yeah, Summer 69 wasn't a hit anywhere other than America and Canada at the time. I actually wrote a song at the time with Jim. It was called I Can't Get My Songs on the BBC. And the song goes... I don't know what Sir Lou Grade's got against me. I can't get my songs on the BBC.
Brilliant. That could have been The Clash.
I know, Guy, you wanted to talk about the duets, and obviously the big duet.
Yeah, because which is a great aspect of you, Brian. You've done so many duets, and was that something that you consciously wanted to do, or people just came to you? Or
they all sort of happened quite organically. The Tina one I went for and wanted to work with her. I'm trying to think what the next one was.
Barbara Streisand, maybe. Bonnie Raitt. Oh, right. Yeah.
Bonnie asked me to sing on her show. Oh, I love Bonnie. Man.
She's
so good. And then David Foster asked me to do the Barbara Streisand one. And the song wasn't there. I said, but you know what? Send me the music and I'll see if I can write a song around it. And they sent me the score by Marvin Hamlisch, the great Marvin Hamlisch.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, wow. There's a name.
And I sat down with Mutt and we rewrote the song. I sent it in and didn't hear anything. And then about a month later, I get a call and Barbara comes on. She says, "What'd you do to my song?" I said, "Oh my God." I rewrote it. She goes, "I like it."
So, was that must have been a bit of a moment before she said that.
I mean, I wasn't going to take offense if she didn't like it. It was just a punt, you know, just to see if it could be better.
But did you get to meet Marvin?
I did. I went to work with Marvin, and it was one of the best experiences because we went to the Sony Studios in Los Angeles to record the strings for the song. And Marvin was, to my great surprise, quite a comic in that way, that sort of New York Jewish comedy. So he'd get up in front of the, you know, 60-piece orchestra and sort of open up the score and say, "Yeah, good morning, everybody. Did you hear about the, you know, the snake and the squirrel?" And he'd start telling jokes to everybody. Just so funny. And I thought, you know, when's the session going to happen? Because he just kept rattling off all these jokes. And then it was like tap, tap with the baton and off we went and then recorded the strings. It was just such a sweet memory.
The thing with you, do you have an idea for a song and think, "Oh my God, this needs to be two people, this needs to be two points of view," or is it more, "I want to do a duet, I'm going to tailor a song to that"?
Oh, I see. No, I never really think about, well, with the Barbara one, I did think about it. I wanted it to be like a conversation. I really wanted it to have that dialogue between two people. And I did another one with Sarah McLachlan, which was very similar for the Spirit soundtrack, which again was kind of like two people with two different thoughts. That's called Don't Let Go. That's such a beautiful song too. I don't know if you've heard that or not.
Yeah, that was a big album for you, wasn't it? Sort of spiritually, you felt that was a big album for you.
It was, yeah. I mean, working with Jeffrey Katzenberg from DreamWorks was, it just changed everything for me.
What was it that you need? Why did you feel that you needed something to come along and change your life?
I didn't. But you know, the universe gives at certain times. And when they came to see me about doing the film for DreamWorks, I didn't quite believe it because I thought it was an audition. I went along thinking that I was going to be stood in the lineup with a bunch of actors, and
I've been there.
When I got to the theater, I said, "Oh, where's everybody else?" Katzenberg looks at me and says, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, where's everybody else that you were going to audition today?" He says, "Man, I came here to see you." And I was at a point where I didn't really know what I was doing next, and there was all kinds of other things that were happening. And I said, "Oh," I said, "Well," he says, "come on, let's go watch the movie." And so it was all done in pencil sketch. It was the last animated film that was done with hand drawing.
Wow.
And we sat down and we watched these sketches, and I said, "Wow, this is incredible." He says, "I want you to be the voice of the horse." I said, "Wow, okay." I said, "As long as it's not, that's the only part of the horse you want me to be." and so I spent a year working with Hans Zimmer, doing the set.
Ah, Hans, yeah.
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience. And because it was so much fun, I was able just to carry on. But I mean, I was literally at a point where I thought, what am I doing next? And that was the perfect thing.
And do you think your work in movies informed you in how to approach a musical when you're working on Pretty Woman? Or is it a different ballgame entirely?
Anything I knew about songwriting, I had to throw out the window when I came to working on the musical, because I'm just really talking about from a lyrical perspective. You can think you've nailed it, and you walk into the room, and every day when, literally it was an everyday thing, every day you'd walk in and you'd have to present what your song was for whatever the scene was that the director wanted, and there'd be a panel of, you know, 10 people, and so you'd say, "Okay, well, let's demo disclaimer, here comes the song," and you'd play the song, and the writer would say, "Oh, that's great, I really like that," and then someone else would say, "I don't know, I like the third line," and you sort of look at it, you know, Jim and I would look at each other like, "What?" And so after a while, I became really, you know, blasé to the criticism. I just thought, "Well, okay, we'll just write something else." And so we would just go back, and so we'd have our 11 o'clock meeting
do a song presentation, and then go back and sit in my tiny little hotel room on 44th Street and just write another song or rewrite that one. It was exasperating in some respects because I don't know sometimes whether they knew what they wanted or they just didn't know if they liked that or if the direction musically might have been suitable for someone else but not for that particular group, you know. And because everyone was allowed to have a say, it would just take time.
But that's the thing with musicals, isn't it? It is ultimately, because Gary and I have written musicals together, it's the ultimate kind of collaborative art form, but it's kind of different in that there's just the guy from the record company going, oh, I don't like this, just because he doesn't like it. It's kind of, people will have a valid reason for why it doesn't fit in with the bit that they need to make work.
Yeah, it's sort of subjective in the sense that if you're working with somebody that is like-minded in what you're doing, then it becomes easier. However, if you're working with someone that isn't in your world and you're trying to present them or convince them of this, then it's a little more difficult. You know what I'm saying?
There's a famous Sondheim quote, though, isn't it? That a musical is never written, it's always rewritten. It's
rewritten, yeah.
Which sort of sums that up. Because you've got to, lyrically, you've got to take your character from A to B, haven't you? There's got to be a dramatic flow within the song. And that's very different
to
pop songs.
Yeah. Exactly. You've got to start somewhere and end somewhere else, haven't you?
There's no room for metaphors at all.
Yeah. And pop songs tend to be a sort of snapshot of something where a musical song, you know, it has to have drama.
That's why I'm talking to you guys.
You were happy in the end with what the sort of the way the process worked for you and the final stage.
I actually really enjoyed the whole thing. I mean, even though sometimes you think, wow, that's too bad because that was a good song. I just ended up, any songs that got rejected, I ended up recording them anyway.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, you have that great other outlet, don't you? Because that's the thing with musicals, isn't it? It's kill your darlings. You have to be prepared to lose your favorite song at any
point. Oh, I hate that expression, killing your darlings. I just can't. No, but you know, in a way, it's true, you know?
Brian, I know we haven't got much time. There's so much other, because I wanted to sort of touch briefly on your photography, because you've got a CV as a photographer, which any photographer who'd literally never done anything else would be perfectly happy to have, I would have thought.
Okay.
No, it's just look at the people you photograph. I was wondering how that started. It was always an interest of yours?
Yeah, it was always an interest of mine, and I started. Kind of started very sort of simply on tour, taking pictures in the studio and sort of documenting work, being the ultimate sort of fly on the wall. And from there, and stupidly, I never published my pictures back on the early records because I just thought that I wasn't, you know, you can't be a photographer, you know. You have to get a real photographer. But looking back on some of my pictures, I was thinking, why didn't I publish these? They're so much better than what we ended up using. And
you ended up doing album covers for other people?
I have done, yeah.
Did you? Yeah.
I have done. In fact, most recently, I did Rammstein's album cover.
Oh, man, I saw that on your Instagram. It's fantastic.
I mean, it's the second time I've worked with them. And it was so fun to do it. Because, I mean, first of all, I love being in Berlin. But also I love the band. I was very lucky to have got it.
But I have to ask, how was the Queen?
Which one?
There's been so many.
Elizabeth II. How? I mean, you get to photograph her. That's quite an extraordinary thing to do. That's like Cecil B.
It was very, very nice to have got that. I was great friends with Josef Karsh, who's a Canadian photographer. And I went to see his exhibition at Canada House sometime in the late 1999 or something like that, 90s. And he said, oh, I want you to meet my friend from Camera Press, because Karsh liked my pictures, even though he hadn't seen very many. He liked what I was doing. And he said, I want you to meet Richard from Camera Press. And he said, oh, I like what you've done recently. Would you like to join Camera Press? I said, yeah, sure. And then about a year later, he phoned me and said, what are you doing on Wednesday? I said, oh, I don't know, nothing really. He says, would you like to photograph the Queen? I said, oh, yeah, I'd love to. I said, but where? He says, well, it's at her house. Which house? He says, Buckingham Palace. And you can see the eyes rolling. Anyway, it was a very good experience. And I photographed Philip as well, Prince Philip.
Amazing.
Fantastic. But
Brian, I did a show with you back in 87. We all got up on stage with George Harrison, Ringo Starr. I think we kind of took it for granted at the time that we were playing on stage with Beatles. It was an amazing sort of, you know, Phil Collins, Eric Clapton. It was at the Prince's Trust in Wembley, in front of the Prince of Wales. Your work in charity is so vast. And what I just wanted to say is that what's interesting is you do so much, and yet you don't try and write songs about these subjects, you know, maybe like a Bono would. What you do, I think, is you seem to go to various countries like India or wherever you are, and you deliver joy. But underneath are what you believe in, is what you believe in, the statements that you want to make.
Thank you. I don't really, I don't talk about it very much. I have a little foundation, and it sort of bumbles along. And most of the proceeds from my photography go to it. It's like helping people help people.
It's part of it that, you know, we're in such a fortunate situation, and we, you know, we get to do the job that is a dream job, and we love doing that. And there's an element of, don't get me, I don't want you to misunderstand me, but is there an element of guilt that we have about how lucky we are that makes us make all the more effort in things that are altruistic? Or is it purely that we're in a great position and therefore we should be doing that?
Well, I think when it comes to musicians, the moment you get anywhere, people will start knocking on your door and asking you to be part of things. And so it's at that point you have to decide, you know, what you want to do, if you want to support this and if you don't, because there are so many things you can support. And there might be something that touches your heart and you think, yeah, I'm going to do that because it's part of it. I know someone that had that, or my friend was affected by it, or, you know, I've been to a country that had that, and I relate to it. So you'll end up finding somewhere inside of you that there's something that connects you to the things you get asked to do. I don't know that if you didn't become well known that it would happen so frequently, but
that's a fair point. That's a very fair point. It's a two-way thing, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of.
Brian, we're going to let you go, but I can't let you go without mentioning the fact that because of you, I met my wife 22 years ago, and we have three children.
Oh, what?
Lauren was helping you style some photographs.
That's right.
And there was a party at the Saatchi Gallery.
Oh, wow.
Where you were auctioning these pictures off for charity. And I met her.
Oh, that's so sweet, man. I do remember that now. I do remember. And congratulations.
Brian, I can't help but notice that your name is actually Brian Guy Adams. And my name is Guy Adam. and the reason I was called that is because my dad was a songwriter and actor. And as we know, Pratt is a pretty unfortunate surname. And when I was born, my mum thought, well, you know, he might want to go into showbiz. So she gave me a middle name that would work as a surname. So I could have been Guy Adams.
Oh, that's a good name. I was named because I was born on 5th of November. The Brian comes from my father. He wanted to name me after Sir Brian Horlicks, which is who was a British general. So that.
Yeah. Well, my dad was born on the 5th of November too. So
touched on your peripatetic childhood and your.
Well, it's too late now, Guy, isn't it?
It's too late now. I know.
Guy. Get your pajamas out.
Yes.
And go and have a walk, okay?
Enjoy the rest of your tour, Brian.
You guys.
Thank you so much.
Hope to see you soon.
All right. Lots of love.
Back, man. See you later.
Thank you so
much. Bye-bye.
Well, that was lovely, wasn't it?
Very nice of all three of us, I thought, to break with our tour schedule and do this podcast.
it's absolutely true. I mean, we're all on quite fierce schedules here.
We are. It's quite tricky, but
we're
desperately
fishing for sympathy from our audience now, aren't we?
Yeah. So, as if you're listening to this on Sunday, when our podcast normally gets delivered to you, we are in Budapest.
Oh.
In the meantime, we are going to be going down to Lithuania.
Yes, the last of the Baltic states, states.
Yeah, these are beautiful cities, Riga. Tallinn, I mean, just stunning stuff that wouldn't be on my list normally as a place to visit, but oh my God, I'm going to be telling people to come.
It's true, yeah. You should check our Instagram feeds for, like, fabulously boring tourist photos.
Yeah. Lots of pictures of Guy in multiple scarves.
Multiple scarves.
See you next week, won't we?
We will see you next week. Yeah, hopefully we're still trudging away, trying to find people. We're not trying to find people, but trying to find time to do the people that we do find.
Yes.
So it's good night from me.
And it's good night from everybody in this beautiful city of Reading.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.